Blog Talk Radio.
So those faithless and perverse generation. What do you say? Faithless and what else? What makes a man get perverted without faith? What's perverted our Christianity? Faithless.
Well, say that profess that God has given you power, love, and a sound mind, and your mind is not sound. You don't have power to overcome your present situation and circumstances.
Now the devil is always pushing. You can recognize the demons working because they always push to impetuous, immediate action. Don't think, do. And the devil says, if you don't do it now, you'll miss the opportunity. If you don't move now, if you don't sell now, if you don't jump now, it'll be gone.
And the kingdom of God is best expressed by authority and power to cast out devils.
Listen, dear friends, don't forget that little word he said, seek ye first. Come on, that's the secret right there, seek ye first. Seek ye first. Oh, I tell you, the average person said, seek me first. That's it, seek me first. Put me first.
Well, anyone who opposes the kingdom of God and the casting out of devils. Because when we're of God's kingdom, our sole purpose is to destroy Satan's kingdom. Our sole purpose is to cast down Satan's kingdom.
I can tell you whether you won souls or not, whether you get your prayers answered, whether you're happy or not, whether you got a happy home or not, whether you're worth killing in the church or not. I can tell you, if you log your time and let me see how you start your day out, if you grab a cup of coffee and a newspaper and sit there for an hour and let the Bible go begging, brother, you're mixed up in worldliness.
The Word of God said, we're going over to the other side. And in the midst of the Word of God saying, we are going over to the other side, the enemy showed up in the storm. And the first thing that the enemy did was challenge those who walk with Christ. Those who eat with him and slept with him and saw the miracle, the signs and the wonders done by him. The first thing that the enemy did was steal the word that they heard right out of their heart and then allow doubt to rise up on the inside of them. And instead of believing what the word of God said, they said, Lord, we perish.
Reading the word that's going to give you faith, that isn't what he's talking about. It isn't just hearing the word that's going to give you faith. You've got to open your spiritual ear or eye as you hear or read the word and appropriate by faith. Make it yours.
That'll sober you up. That ought to melt your silly heart. I'm not interested in your feelings and your little silly sentimentality. I'm wondering about your love for Christ and compassion for others. Do you care? I'm asking you one question tonight. Do you love Jesus or do you love this stinking world?
But God wants us to be doers of the word and not hearers only. Deceiving ourselves. How many folks are deceived every single week? Going to hear what they call the word and it never once emboldens them or give them a desire or a passion to do the works of Christ.
We want just a bunch of sickly sentimentality, and we want to just fix up sort of a hiding place and a loophole for sinners to say, well, if that old cuss made it in, I can make it in myself.
The kingdom is within you. And the only kingdom that this world is going to understand until the king comes is what they see in us. Because now we are the only creatures that have the ability to walk in darkness and to walk in light.
Oh, God, people, go!
All right, glory to the King. Can anybody hear me? Am I coming in now? Hallelujah. Testing, 1-2, test. Testing, 1-2. Hallelujah. Am I being heard? All right, we got confirmation. Glory to the King. I appreciate that. I don't know. Every time we get a new piece of equipment in here, I just don't do well with it. So Teacher Shane got a microphone and my last blog talk, he came up here and set it up for me, and I thought I had it figured out, but obviously I didn't. But hey, we got the backup, the same comm system that Sister Ashley uses for her. So we on the air. Anyway, hey, Shalom, bless you all. Hope you all doing well. Good to see you in the room tonight, my brothers and sisters, as always. Hope you had a beautiful first day. We were busy at Straightway Ministries today, and I'm sure that you all were butchering our meat birds again today to put more of our home-raised meat birds in the freezer. Always quite a task, and I'm feeling it. I'm telling you what, I'm feeling it. But I got to say this, after we cleaned the poop today, I'm thinking to myself, man, there ain't nobody, I think, in this ministry that has shoveled more shit than me and Sister Diane. Oh, my God. Over the years, I'm telling you, I have shoveled a lot of crap, chicken manure over the years. But hey, glory to the King, it's all good. Man, we should be thankful and rejoicing in the Most High, and I hope that y'all going to be make it the top of your priority. Go back and listen to the Shepherds, Pastor Dowell's, the message he preached yesterday on the power of the Holy Spirit. As you can clearly see, that Yah is trying to get us prepared, you know, for the days ahead, and especially for this Feast of Tabernacles, as we know that always at the feast days, the Most High is here in a profound way with healings and deliverance. So, you know, get your hearts and minds prepared to receive that word every week, week in and week out. And we thank Yah that we are privileged enough and honored enough that He would invite us into His Shabbat so we could hear these things. But anyway, glory to the King. I do want to recognize and give all praise, honor, and glory to the Most High. Without Him, we can do nothing. I thank Him for allowing me to have another week and allowing me the honor to come before the saints tonight. I hope this message is one of education. Strange topic. I don't know if anybody saw what teacher put up there, study topic, but I called it the widow because I don't know how it came about. I really don't know how it came about, but I guess I was reading something, it's been piquing my interest, so I started looking a little bit more into the widows and the structure of the widows in Israel and in relation to the Old Testament and the New Testament, you know, compared to the Torah and then Paul's writings and, you know, the widows historically in Israel. And I think I found it, you know, discovered a very profound parallel, and especially when it comes to the reason Paul wrote his letters concerning widows and marriage a certain way that he did. And it's more obvious to see when it gets all put together that, obviously Paul understood the Torah, and he you know, just put it all together when he reflected his direction. We're going to be in 1 Timothy 5 a lot tonight, you know, for Timothy concerning the widows. So he just drew from what Yah had already established way back he gave the Torah to his people. So with that, again, always grateful, Brother Ugly, for being faithful to, you know, post the scriptures and the definitions for the saints. I greatly appreciate it. I'm thankful that y'all are in the room with me tonight and took time out of your busy day to, you know, sit and listen. Of course, this ministry, I think Pastor talked about on Blog Talk the other night, we put out a tremendous amount of information. I know we hear it all the time, but all that is taking away every excuse that we have for not getting into the kingdom, for not being, you know, pure in the sight of the Most High, getting ourselves ready. That's all that is. So, and we thank Him. We truly should. Anyway, we're going to get started. This is going to go well over an hour, as it is with all topics. You know, you could keep going, so you try to figure out where to cut it short. But I hope that it is edifying. That again, it's kind of a different topic, but I hope that in some way, shape, or form that you can draw something from it. So with that, we're going to get started, and I do hope that you all enjoy. So with that, we're going to begin. Anyway, a few bullet points. Now, again, this is the widow or widows in Israel. Now, Yah was the widow's protection and the provider. A widow was considered equivalent to the status of the stranger and fatherless, of a low stature and importance. A widow stood the chance of losing her husband's estate if it had debt attached to it. Paul dealt with younger widows whose hearts were toward seeking out a husband rather than wait for the possibility of a husband willing to cover them. I believe Paul clearly understood the provisions to take care of the widows and the fatherless, and this does reflect in his letters. And there is no Torah, no law, that commands the brother to raise up seed for his brother through the dead brother's wife if she already had children. And we all know about the Levirate law, that if a woman have a husband, he die, and they have no seed, that it goes, the brother of the deceased man is supposed to raise up, take her for a wife and raise up seed in the name of the dead brother. And in the case with widows with children, that law doesn't apply. And it's gives us another kind of idea and an insight as to why there were so many widows in Israel. But anyway, we're going to get on with this. So, as I said, Yahweh is the one. He is the protection provider for the widow and the fatherless children. And with that, we're going to start in Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 17 and 18. Alrighty. For Yahweh, your Elohim, is the Elohim of gods, and the master of masters, a great Elohim, a mighty, and the terrible, which regardeth not persons, nor taketh reward. So right here in Deuteronomy, Moses is given a description of who our Elohim is. And his character. And he does execute the judgment of the fatherless and the widow, and loveth the stranger in giving him food and raiment. And the word fatherless, you're going to hear that brought up a lot of times. It definitely can, widow woman with children, her and her children, because her children would be without a father, as she would be without a husband, and it can also apply to orphan children. And, reading Deuteronomy 10, 17, and 18, it's clear that Yah is going to punish those who maltreat the widows and the fatherless. And meaning Yah is actually the overseer. He's acting in the capacity of covering for a widow and the fatherless. He is the one that is going to protect and provide. Exodus chapter 22, verses 22 through 24. Exodus 22 through 24. And Moshe writes, you shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, Yah was very particular about those that were living in the state of typically poverty and depression and an oppressed situation. He was guarding them. He was the one that was watching over them. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cries. So we know that Yah's ear is open to the cries of the widow and the fatherless child. And my wrath shall wax hot. This is how we're seeing how diligent and how serious Yah's behavior is towards those that would dare to misuse and mistreat the widows and the fatherless. And my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword. I don't think there's any class of other people that Yah put so much emphasis on, you leaving your hands off them. And your wives shall be widows, and your children fathers. So if you think that you're going to go out there and afflict and oppress and take advantage of the widow and the fatherless, her and her children, or the orphans, I'll tell you what, this is what's going to happen to you. I will kill you with the sword, man, and then your wives and your and shall be widows, and your father's children shall be fatherless as well. You know, Yah will render punishment against those who come against those who have no male covering. So they have no direct male covering over them to protect them, to keep them from wrongdoing. Widows were open to being exploited and used. They were in a position to be taken advantage of because they had no husband to deal with others in sensitive matters. It is amazing how sensitive Yah is to the plight of the widow, the fatherless, and the stranger, to the point where he and not men oversee to their welfare and well-being, meaning that he's directly involved in their lives. And he uses men, obviously, but he is directly involved in his lives to watch over and take care of them. Deuteronomy 27, verse 19. Again, we're going over some scriptures here in the Torah, just showing how the Most High is very particular, very serious-minded, and very on the guard against anybody coming against the widows, the fatherless, and we're going to find out strangers as well. Cursed be he that perverteth or turn aside the judgment, or which means the cause of the stranger, fatherless, and widow. And all the people shall say, Amen. So the people all agreed that you're going to have a curse placed on you if you turn aside the cause of the stranger, the father, because they're obviously needed. They're going to have causes. They're going to have, they're going to be needing help. And to turn them away would actually bring a curse upon you. Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 17, a single verse. Again, thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger, nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. Now, to take a widow's clothing as collateral against debt, that's what we're talking about here. Widows would borrow against the things left to them from the estate of their dead husband. Oftentimes, women who became widows at the death of their husbands had to bear the burden of settling the husband's debts he may have incurred in his life. Widows, especially those without older sons, were susceptible to losing lands and properties by selling them off in order to settle debts. So if they got too much in the hole, their husband, you know, he suddenly died or was killed in war, whatever the case may be, you know, if he had debt, it went on to the family, directly on to the widow and the children. And in order for her to keep the inheritance and the children, she had to take care of that debt. So what Yah is saying here, a widow cannot use her raiment, her clothing, to actually give in exchange for collateral for debt. Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17. Again, Isaiah 1, 17. We're just going through the scriptures and the prophets and the writings to, you know, because it's written about so many places about how Yah feels about the widows, the fatherless, and the strangers. All right, learn to do well, meaning, you know, being beneficial and caring towards the oppressed. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow. And when it's written here in Isaiah, pleading means to defend, strive for the cause of the widow. So that's how you learn to do well, when you relieve the oppressed. As Brother Ugly's got it up there, those are on the chat. Relieve the oppressed, judge the fatherless, and defend for the widow. This is learning to do well. Psalm 68, verses 4 and 5. And Dawid writes, or he sings, sing unto Yahweh, sing praises to his name. Extol him that rideth upon the heavens by his name, Yah, and rejoice before him. A father of the fatherless, David recognized Yah's position. And a judge of the widows, a judge being an advocate, or one that supports another of the widows, is Yah in his holy habitation. Even back in generations after the Torah and Yah gave the commandments, we can still see that it's evidently recognized and written of and reminded the people that Yah is the one that is the who supports the widows, and he's as a father to the fatherless. Sirach chapter 4, verse 10. Sirach chapter 4, verse 10. And I think everybody's just following what the narrative is so far. At least I hope so. Glory to the King. Believe me, it's my intention every time when I do a study, when I'm privileged to actually sit down and do a study for the saints on the brother segment, is that they understand as I understand what I'm reading. That is my hope, because if they don't, then it, to me, it's just been a waste, you know, not a waste, but, you know, kind of a futility. So, glory to the King. All right, Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus, chapter 4, verse 10. It says, be as a father unto the fatherless. So, here we're following the same theme that we just read in Psalm 68:5. Be as a father unto the fatherless, and instead of a husband unto their mother, so shalt thou be as the son of the Most High. This is what kind of rank and what type of recognition that one would get if he did these things, being a father unto the fatherless, instead of a husband unto the mother. And he shall love thee more than thy mother does. I mean, this is the great love that Yah, because this particular person who actually does what's written in Sirach 4:10 is going to receive the accolades and the recognition of being somebody that truly cares and has a heart like the Most High after the widows and the fatherless. And I believe this verse is a very good reflection of the sentiments David wrote of in Psalm 68:5. I'm just reading my notes. A son is supposed to reflect the character of his father and instill those sound values in himself and apply them in his life. If you read the previous 9 verses of Sirach chapter 4, because this is verse 10, you will read of, quote, the father figure who is addressing his, quote, son in some valuable wisdom and direction for a profitable life and one approved by Yah. So when you get a chance, go back and read Sirach chapter 4, at least the previous 9 verses. This father figure admonishes his son to deal kindly with those who are oppressed and afflicted, who are poor and desolate, and to deal with them with compassion and honor, truly considering their plight. And as we read in Sirach 4:10, we see the council as being one which is focused more on being a sound male figure in the life of the children, without children with those that are without a father, and less of supporting and caring only for the widowed mother. That's not meaning definitely that you have to take her for wife, just saying that, you know, your focus should be more on the children instead of on the woman as far as helping them out. That's why reading the previous 9 verses gives more substance and more context about what verse 10 actually says. All right, staying in Sirach and Ecclesiasticus, we're going to chapter 35, and we're going to go verses 12 through 15. Sirach 35, 12 through 15. Do not think to corrupt with gifts, for such he will not receive, and trust not unrighteous sacrifice. For Yahweh is judge, and with him is no respect of persons. So don't be allowing yourself to get in this position where you can corrupt somebody else with gifts, or and don't trust unrighteous sacrifices, because the Most High is the one that's going to judge us. And you don't care who's doing it, they're going to get the same judgment. He has no respect of persons. He will not accept any person against the poor, but will hear the prayer of the oppressed, meaning that Yahweh will not tolerate anyone doing wrong against the poor person, no matter the greatness of that person. No one is allowed to do wickedly against the poor. Verse 14, and he will not despise the supplication of the fatherless, meaning Yah is not going to despise the needs of the fatherless, nor the widow when she poureth out her complaint. He's going to have an open ear, just like he did when we read earlier in Deuteronomy that if somebody's oppressing them, and Yah is going to hear the cry of the widow, and he's going to attend to the matter personally. Do not the tears run down the widow's cheeks? And why not? I mean, she's poor. She's got a family to raise. She has no husband. She's got all these things in life. And so she's going to feel the weight of her life. And is not her cry against him that causeth them to fall? Or basically anyone who's trying to oppress widow by taking advantage of them, meaning her and her children. So again, this stuff is going to trouble her. It's going to show in her attitude, in her demeanor. It's going to show in her spirit. And, of course, Yah is always watching. So, again, the whole context, the whole reason we're talking about this is because to start out is because we're showing that back in the Old Testament that Yah was the one that was right on top, was the one looking out for the best interests of the widows, the fatherless, and the stranger. Again, there's no Torah that commands that a widowed woman, that somebody cover a widow woman. It's not there. Only a widow woman that didn't have children. But that's why we had widows in Israel. Because they had no husband. They had nobody to cover them, protect them, provide for them. They had to do this themselves. Mark chapter 12. Mark 12, verses 38 through 40. Mark 12, 38 through 40. And he said unto them in his doctrine, this is Yahshua speaking to the people that are standing by listening, beware of the scribes. So he's sending up a warning to these religious figureheads, right? These ones that all the people recognize as the ones that are supposed to have some greater spiritual awareness or authority over them. Beware of the scribes which love to go in long clothing and love salutations in the marketplaces. So he's telling them, look out for these particular scribes and what they're doing. And the chief seats in the synagogues and the uppermost rooms at feast. And what do these no good low-down rats do? Which devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers, these shall receive a greater damnation. Why? Because Jesus knows, of course, obviously he gave Moshe the Torah. And he's reflecting on what he had already stood for way back then when it comes to regards for the widow and the fatherless. That's where the greater damnation would come, because they're oppressing and taking advantage of the widows and their houses, or the widows' estates, the estates that they inherit from their husbands. All right, the word devour, as it is written in Mark chapter 12, verse 40, the one we just read, and I just put it in here, the word devour means forcibly appropriate widow's assets to pay for any debt incurred by their husband before he passed, much like a foreclosure. And it's from the Greek, my notes, help me, Jesus. I'm up in the middle of the night. I do most of my study between midnight and 5 a.m. That's generally what I do because, there's no text, there's no interruptions or anything, and it's quiet, so... But sometimes, boy, getting things messed up here. Anyway, the word devour is used in Mark chapter 12, verse 40, is the Greek 27:19, and this is in the Thayer. And I'm going to skip right down to where it says, forcibly appropriate a widow's property to strip one of his goods. So that's what they were doing. These scribes, these wicked folks, these wicked religious leaders were actually there to try to take advantage of and strip the widow of her assets and take away the living from her and her children. And I bet they did definitely get a greater damnation for that. All right, Numbers chapter 27, verses 8. Number 27, 8 through 11. Numbers 27, 8 through 11. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies, so here's the condition. Now, right away, they're getting our attention. When Moshe is reciting this statute to the people, he starts out to get their attention. If a man died, this is what happens, right? Because there was a situation where a man died and he had no sons. You know the story, and he had the five daughters. Well, this is the result of inquiring to the Most High how to handle this, right? Because inheritance was supposed to go to the firstborn son, to the sons. So this is what, after they inquired, Moses inquired of the Most High, this is what the declaration was. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a man die and have no son, so this is the condition, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass unto the daughter. And the whole point is that the inheritance, and we're talking in regards to the widows and their children, and their properties left by the husband's estate, all these things are going to, are supposed to remain in the family structure. So here, a man die, he leaves a widow, he has no son, and his daughter's supposed to inherit it. And not the widow, but the children of the father, his seed. And if he have no daughter, then he shall give his inheritance unto his brethren, to keeping in the family. And if he have no brethren, then he shall give his inheritance unto his father's brethren. And if his father have no brethren, then he shall give his inheritance unto his kinsman that is next to him of his family. And he shall possess it, and it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute of judgment, as Yahweh commanded Moses. The inheritance always stays the course of that natural bloodline, not a mixed bloodline. And we clearly see that here, right? It doesn't say anything about if the widow was to be covered by another man, that he would get the possessions that were left by the dead husband for his immediate family. This might better explain why there were many widows in Israel that were not covered by another husband, and why Torah was created for the widows and the fatherless to provide for them and protect them. As widows with children, now I'm talking about widows with children strictly when I'm bringing up widows in this case, would not have been considered as desirable in marriage by another man. As all the estate of their deceased husband would not go to the next husband, he couldn't inherit it by marrying her. It remained in her first husband's stead and to his seed. But they would remain with the bloodline of the deceased husband. Another husband would be doing nothing more than adding the extra expense of feeding more mouths when he would gain nothing out of the marriage. So that clearly can see another reason why that law of inheritance was written that way, so men wouldn't take advantage of trying to gain more lands and more estates from widows whose husbands, of course, had passed through the course of marriage. So, I mean, again, another obvious, brilliant move on the Most High, knowing all these things. Deuteronomy chapter 24, Deuteronomy 24, verses 19 through 22. Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 22. And again, we're talking about Yah's protection and the provisions that are afforded through the Most High in his commandments concerning the widows, the fatherless, and the stranger. When thou cuttest down thy harvest in the field, so it's harvest time, right? And they're out there, and the owners of the family and whosever land it is are out there cutting it down, right? And hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that Yahweh Elohim may bless thee in all the work of thy hands. Meaning, you're going to be blessed if you actually do as he has stated right here, commanded in this statute. When thou beatest thine olive trees, all right, so you want to get the olives there out to make olive oil or to eat the olives like they are, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the father, stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. So Yah's making sure that people know this is the provision left for these people in an oppressed life. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman, that thou, you also, the one that was poor and oppressed and desolate, while we're in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command thee to do this thing. You know, it would stand to reason that most widows were poor or living in a state of near poverty. And this is clearly illustrated in the fact that Yahweh left explicit commands to provide sustenance for the widow and her children, for the orphan and the stranger. But there were indeed some widows, such as Judith, who according to the written record was very well off. But the remarkable thing about Judith is that she lived a very humble life, one that reflected poverty and need, as widow women would live, because they came into that state of a depressed lifestyle. Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 12 and 13. Deuteronomy 26, verses 12 and 13. And Moshe writes, when thou hast made an end of tithing all thy tithes of thine increase the third year, which is the year of tithing, so every 3 years, and hast given it unto the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that they may eat within thy gates and be filled, then thou shalt say before Yahweh the Elohim, I have brought away the hallowed things out of mine house, and also have given them unto the Levite and unto the stranger. Hallowed things now, things that are considered holy. All right? And I've given them unto the Levites. These things were meant for the Levite, these hallowed things, these holy things that the tithe was supposed to go to. But this also included, you also included in this same classification as we just read, the widow and the stranger and the fatherless. Out of mine house, and also given them unto the Levite and unto the stranger, to the fatherless and to the widow, according to all thy commandments which thou hast commanded me. I have not transgressed thy commandments, neither have I forgotten them. So again, another way that the Most High is providing for the widows and the fatherless. Jeremiah 49:11. I might be going through these a little bit quicker than I normally would, simply because the point's already been established, who is the one that had made the statutes and the commandments that the widows and the fatherless and the strangers absolutely be taken care of and not to be oppressed, or there's going to be trouble, right? And we need to establish this, because as widows without husband, we're going to see that the same understanding of them not having a husband then is going to be reflected in Paul's letters, all right? All right, Jeremiah 49:11. Leave thy fatherless children, and I will preserve them alive, and let the widows trust in me. Again, because this was a harsh time during the time of Jeremiah. And the prophet, and Yahweh the prophet, put this edict out there about the case of the fatherless and the widows. Let the widows trust in Yah, he'll take care of them, and the fatherless. I will preserve them, and I will keep them in these very serious, oppressed times. All right, widows are commanded to partake in the feast of Yahweh. All right, and we're going to go to Deuteronomy chapter 16, and we're going to read verses 11 through 16. Verses 11 to 16. And of course, the previous 10 verses leading up to 11 verse, they're just talking about the three feasts in the year when all males shall gather before Yahweh the Elohim. And, you know, you heard some, I don't know if you heard, but there's some crazy doctrines that try to go around that only select few males have to go and represent everybody and nobody else is required to travel. I don't even know how you can twist your lip to even come up with that kind of understanding. When here it clearly says that all these people need to be going to where the feast where Yah decides to set his name for his people to gather on his holy feast days. So again, verses 1 through 10 describe what the three feasts are, you know, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of First Fruits, and the Feast of Tabernacles. So verse 11, and thou shalt rejoice before Yahweh the Elohim, thou and thy son, and thy daughter, and thy manservants, and thy maidservant, and the Levite that is within thy gates, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow that are among you. So we can see clearly now this is a feast of the Most High, and he's listing all the people that are going to be there rejoicing. And he doesn't just say only select few or only the males. He's also including the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow that are among you in the place which Yahweh the Elohim have chosen to place his name there. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and again oppressed and overrun and, you know, covered up in much sorrow. And thou shalt observe and do these statutes. And thou shalt observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after that thou hast gathered in the corn and wild wine. And thou shalt rejoice in thy feast, thou. So who's going to be a partaker in this feast? In the Feast of Tabernacles. Who is expecting and commanded to be there to actually be partake in this and enjoy the rejoicing this feast is going to provide? And you have to understand now, it's you know, again, we're going to talk about the fatherless, the widow, and the stranger. These people are oppressed, so somebody's providing for them during this feast. Right? Somebody is making it up so they can actually enjoy and rejoice as well. And I think that was placed upon the people to make sure that those in the oppressed state that lived all the other times of the year actually got to enjoy this and reflect on the Most High. Thou shalt rejoice in thy feast, thou and thy son, thy daughter, and thy manservant and maidservant, and the Levite, the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow that are within thy gates. And I'm not sure if that's some, you know, people that are actually living and maybe squatting on somebody's piece of property. I wasn't sure, but anyway. 7 days thou shalt keep a solemn feast unto Yahweh, the Elohim, in the place. In the place. So you're going to keep the feast in the place which Yahweh shall choose. Meaning that it could be anywhere, and they have to travel to that place. So people have to make provisions to get everybody there. Because Yahweh the Elohim shall bless thee in all thine increase, and all the work of thine hands, therefore thou shalt surely rejoice. 3 times in a year shall all males appear before Yahweh the Elohim in the place which he shall choose. Again, I'm rereading. In the Feast of Unleavened Bread, in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles, and they shall not appear before Yah empty. So much for this idea that there was only a select few males that needed to be present at Yah's set-apart feast. It is quite clear that that Israel, primarily the men, were tasked with ensuring that not only those within their gates needed to attend the feast and be at the feast, but also that there was a responsibility of the able body to make sure the widow, the fatherless, and strangers were in attendance so they too could enjoy the fruits of the feast. So we can see that the widows were, you know, even though they were oppressed, they were deemed the, you know, probably least important in society, but yet they had such the eye of the Most High, and yeah, because they had no protection, no husband over them again, but they were expected, and the men of Israel expected to look over them and watch over them, and this would actually be counted them as a blessing from the Most High. Luke chapter 4, verses 25 and 26. Luke chapter 4, verses 25 and 26. And Yahshua says, "But I tell you of a truth. I'm going to tell you the whole truth. I'm going to tell you the way it is. Many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias." Why were there so many widows? Why weren't they married? Why wasn't everybody covered? But no, Jesus is making it plain that there were many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias, or meaning Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout all the land. So we had all these women, or all these widows, and the fatherless as well, and there were so many of them during that time frame. But unto none of them was Elias sent, save unto Sarepta, a city of Sidon, unto a woman that was a widow. All right. So the point that I read this again is that Yahshua testified that there were many widows in Israel during the days of Elijah the prophet. These widows were living in the time of little to nothing for food, only added more hardship to their already desperate plight. It's very probable that because of the conditions caused by this massive drought, that the every man for himself attitude caused the widows and fatherless to be often overlooked as men would strive to provide for their immediate household. Again, you know, it's dog eat dog, that kind of thing, when there's a lack of food. But the fact of the matter is, for whatever reason during this time, many men had died or perished and left a lot of women and their children to fend things out for themselves. There was no command, there was no Torah, there was no direction at all for these widows to be covered by a husband at all. Again, as we've been reading all along, Yahweh is their protector and provider. You have to ask yourself, why wasn't Torah put in place with a widow woman with children, that she would have a man over her? But it never was. It never was. You can't find it anywhere. The only time we see a widow woman, again, is the Levirate law. And that's because she needed to have seed from her deceased husband. So we all know the condition behind that. All right, we're going to jump into 1 Timothy, and it's going to be pretty much the entire chapter. It is going to be, and what we're going to do in this is we're going to be reading 1 Timothy. I have to go see where we're going to stop. I think it's like verse 16, so it's going to be 1 through 16. But in between this, as we go through verses, we're going to go to other places in the Word that kind of add emphasis to what that particular verse that we're reading at the time is saying. So, you know, line upon line type of thing. So when we go jumping around, don't lose the focus that this is all about the widows and being covered and their attitude and the attitude of the Most High towards the widow. All right. Starting off, 1 Timothy chapter 5, the very first verse, verse 1. And Paul, this is Paul's letter to Timothy, the one that had the gift in him that was told not to ignore it, but you're going to need to use it. So Paul is writing Timothy, and he's giving Timothy upfront advice and counsel and direction and instruction about how to prepare himself to use the gift that Yah has given him. And the first thing is he's talking about in regards to people he has in the assembly. That's what most of verse chapter 5 is, people that are actually going to be a part of the assembly there, or are part of the assembly. Paul starts out by writing, rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren. Now clearly Paul is pointing out two age groups of men, those that are older and those that are younger, and how they should be dealt with. Paul is defining for Timothy who he is depicting. Older men, younger men, right? And how to entreat them, how to treat them, how to deal with them. The older is fathers, as you would with your father, with honor and respect, not getting up in their face, not speaking evil of them, not getting irate. And then the younger men as brothers, you know, as mature men and brothers and sisters, being able to speak about things face to face. All right, in my notes, what defines an elder? At what age is an older man considered an elder? See, I don't know, but we do know by Yahshua in John chapter 8 that thou art not 50 years old, so we always kind of consider that the line from brethren to the age of elder. It is those men which have raised children, that have grown and have children. Okay, that's my def. I don't even know why I read my note there, sorry. Rebuking not an elder of the age, but one of appointment would imply that the elder of appointment is regarded as an older man who possesses the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding as afforded those who live many years. Meaning that what I'm bringing that up for, and I find it necessary, because Paul is writing in regards mostly to age, but also we can use the same parallel is to those that are actually given the title of elder, because they have the capacity and they have the wisdom, the knowledge, and the understanding as a man that's well-aged, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, like Elder Mitchell, he's a young elder, but he definitely has the wisdom of a great many older men, you know, just by virtue of the gift that lies in him. All right, in verse 2, so Paul covered men, now he's going to cover women. The elder women as mothers, the younger sisters with purity. So he's, again, telling Timothy how you're supposed to conduct yourself with these certain people and how the people are supposed to you know, be with each other. So, you know, we are to entreat the old elder women and younger sisters in the same regards that we are to entreat the older men versus the younger men. So you get two instructions here. And then Paul, now he's talking about older men, younger men, older women, younger women. Now he's going to come up here and he's going to take off to start talking about widows. Isn't that something? I mean, he's going to start hitting widows. He could be talking about divorcees or, you know, people that are in spiritual authority. But no, he's going to start talking about widows because there must have been something going on that Paul had experienced through all the years of, you know, spreading the word in all of his travels, that he realized a lot of things that were happening with the widows. So he's instructing Timothy how we're going to deal with the widows, right? This is very important. He jumps right into it. Honor widows that are widows indeed, or those widows that are prized and revered. That's what he means by the word indeed. So honor widows that are prized and revered because of the things that they have done in their life despite not having a husband. Even back then, these women have no male covering. All right? Honor widows indeed, recognizing only those women who have lost a husband and remain as widows and doing that which becometh widows in lifestyle and conduct. And again, this is already following what we just read in the Old Testament about once a lot of these women lost their husbands, especially the ones with children, and they remained widows. We're going to be seeing the same reflection of it in Paul's instructions to Timothy here, which becometh widows in lifestyle and conduct. And how are we to ascertain those who qualify as widows indeed? Paul is going to go on in his letter to Timothy and detail what and who true widows actually are. Paul is also implying those widows that are prized and revered. They have a special place. Paul is also implying not to honor those widows who are not truly widows indeed. That's why he's making a distinction. The ones that are going to get the honor are the ones that are truly the widows indeed, the ones that fit the bill, the ones that actually have, we're going to find out, stayed the course, right? Paul is asserting a crucial point to Timothy, to only revere those widows who are, point of fact, truly gone through widowhood. And again, Paul, never forget this as we're talking and going over, that Paul is reflecting. He's coming from an attitude and understanding of the Old Testament instruction when it comes to the widow and fatherless. Nothing new under the sun. 1 Timothy, we're on verse 4 now. But if any widow have children or nephews, all right, so he's again breaking it down. So now we're only having, you know, we're going to start showing what is the cause and the course of those widows that have children or nephews. But if any widow have children or nephews, and if you look behind the word nephews, simply is grandchildren, right? So any widow have children or grandchildren, or they raised, obviously had adult children who went on to have their children, so she not only has her adult children, but also grandchildren. Let them, meaning the children and the grandchildren, learn first to show piety, meaning to reverence towards their mother, their widowed mother, at home, and to requite, or which means to give back to and help support their parents, for that is good and acceptable for Yah. And you might get tripped up on the word parents here, but typically you look behind the definition, it means singular, parent, and it actually says mother too. So so they're supposed to show piety, which means of the children, to honor their mother as the command is written, in spite of the fact that they have no father. So they were still practice what Torah said as far as it going to honor thy father and mother, despite the fact that there was no father. The honor still was extended towards the mother. Paul just wrote to Timothy to honor those widows who are widows indeed, those that are prized and revered. And in this verse, he breaks away from those who are widows indeed and details for Timothy about those widows who have children and grandchildren. So he started about the widows indeed. Now he's going on talking about the children and grandchildren. Paul's instructing Timothy that, excuse me, that the widows which still have children in their life and grandchildren, that the children who would be growing, she had grandchildren, we just talked about it, and the grandchildren help support the needs of their widowed mother who has no husband to provide her. And so you have adult children, and they're entrusted to help support her in her later years because, she has no husband to take that course. So the children were tasked to make sure they took care and supported the mother, the children, the grandchildren. As it was in the case of those women in the past days, the days of old, who lost their husbands, that they would need the help of their children to not only help support the household, but also to help in ensuring that their inheritance remained in that family and that the children of the widow would be the benefactors of their parents' estate. And this shouldn't be confused as meaning something contrary to what Paul wrote to the assembly at Corinth when he instructed the parents to lay up or keep in store for the children, not the children for the parents. And we're going to get a little bit more into that. You know, because when you start talking about looking into investigating widows and doing a study into them, it goes into a lot into inheritance and how that works, and it can get pretty deep. But again, I put this in here in the emphasis of Paul wrote up because, again, he's talking about the children. Parents are to lay up, not to be confused with the children supporting or keeping the widow in a state where she can actually live. Kept in store for the children, not the children for the parents. This had to do with the parents holding in store for the children their rightful inheritance and not with the children helping in supporting their widow. That's what I'm trying to say here. Paul wrote that as a separate clause in there to the church at Corinth, right? This doesn't have anything to do with what he's talking about to Timothy about the children and grandchildren supporting the mother. This is a whole other situation when it's talking about inheritance, not direct support, day-to-day support. Glory to the King. I hope I made that clear because I had to take a look at it and try to make it clear myself. All right, glory to the King. All right, now we're in verse 5, 1 Timothy 5, 5. Now she that is a widow indeed, so far we've covered elder men, younger men. We've covered elder women, younger women. We've covered widows that are widows indeed or prized and revered. And now we've covered widows with children and how the children are supposed to take care of them and honor them. And now we're going on to back to the ones that are actually widows that are prized and revered. Now she that is a widow indeed. Paul's going to break this down for Timothy, how to categorize who these particular widows are, the one that should be considered prized and revered. And desolate, trusteth in Yah and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. So he is making the distinction outside of all the other widows. These are the category of widows that are actually widows indeed. They are desolate, meaning being single. They trusteth in Yah, continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. Their devotion, their drive, their temperament, their attitude is all towards the Most High and trusting Him. This all reflects what we just read in the Old Testament as it comes to the widows and the fatherless. Paul breaks down for Timothy how to define widows which are widows indeed. Paul writes that they are desolate, meaning they are single and alone, meaning having no children to support them or help take care of them, that they place their trust, their hope and confidence in Yah, and that they are prayer warriors, always being about the Master's business, interceding in the prayer of the saints, as most of their burdens and distractions in daily living would be behind them. Because they have the assembly. They have no children directly, so it's charged to the assembly. We'll get to that too. But they can be focused on serving the Most High and Him alone. You know, living would be behind them, such as raising children, grandchildren, that they would have no constraints that would take them away from being on their faces before Yah at all times, day and night. This also could safely be assumed that these widows are those which are of greater age, as being in the state of older women. Again, we're going to quote Yahshua in the book of Luke. We have an idea of what a widow indeed actually might be. So Luke chapter 2, verses 36 and 37. Remember I said that we're going to jump in and out of 1 Timothy here, chapter 5. So Luke chapter 2, verses 36 and 37. All right. There was one Anna, a prophetess, a daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher, so given her lineage and heritage. She was of great age. She was an older woman and had lived with a husband 7 years from her virginity. So she was definitely married, right? But she was a widow of about 84 years. So she's an 80-year-old woman now, great age. At some point she lost her husband. Is just her. But look what she does. This 80-year-old woman has no husband, has no other distraction. Children are probably gone, whatever the case may be. And, of course, the assembly then, she was taken care of some way, shape, or form. And she departed not from the temple, but served Yah. She trusted in Yah, served Yah with fasting and prayers night and day. So why is it so incomprehensible that Paul is only reflecting and writing about the same thing when Yahshua already spoke about it, or there was already a record of it in Luke, what an actual widow of great age, ones that are widows indeed, are actually doing. They trust in Yah, they're desolate, single and alone, and continue with them supplications and prayers night and day. This should be their focus. They're not going to find themselves as younger widows, as we're going to look into. They're going about causing hell, being rebellious and everything else. Their whole focal point of their age, because they've lived a life, they've done all this stuff, and now their whole focal point is to supplication and prayers night and day towards the Most High. All right, going on to verse 6, back to 1 Timothy 5, verse 6. So Paul just got done talking about the widow indeed. He talked about the widow with children. Now he's talking what the case of the children are towards the widow. And all of a sudden he said, that she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. You know, it appears that Paul is speaking on those widows who have the conditions of being in a place, in the place of widows indeed, those who are single, undistracted with the daily affairs of family, free to serve Yah continually without burden, that these widows which are more about, but these are widows which are more about themselves. Now, these are older, foolish women, right? In this case, because that's the narrative, that's what he's talking about, it's the context about widows indeed. Now he's going to those that live in pleasure. They might as well be dead. I mean, they're old, they're aged. What's the sense of living anymore? Because they have no devotion, no direction towards the Most High. So it's still all about them, even in their older age. They haven't learned anything. And these widows, they're more about themselves. They serve themselves, satisfy their fleshy desires rather than Yah. These widows are useless to the body of Messiah and have no value or impact in their roles as if they were already in the grave. And that's what I mean. They might as well just be dead because it's all they consider in life is just what they can get after the flesh and not interceding to the Most High on behalf of Israel. Okay, in verse 7. And these things given charge, that they may be blameless. Remember now, we're talking about widows. They have no husband. They have no covering. And Paul is writing to Timothy what to do with all these women that had once had a husband and now no longer have a husband, right? He's going to come a lot from what we already know, the narrative and the understanding that widows didn't necessarily have the provision to be married again. That not only was back in the Old Testament Yah commanded to be taken care of, but in the New Testament there's a structure put in place that their own household would make sure that they were taken care of. So it's following the same theme. There's no change, nothing new under the sun, and Yah hasn't changed anything. And these things give in charge that they may be blameless. Okay, so he's Paul is asserting to Timothy, demanding of Timothy to make this understanding of the state of widows and what their role should be, and those of their family, if they have such, that they would be without fault and not deviate from that which should be the coming of widows. So he's making a distinct point to Timothy. You give these things in charge. You make sure you attack this thing. Make it known. Don't let it slide. This stuff has to be addressed, right? So nobody can be, that they may be blameless, that nobody can say they didn't know, they didn't understand, that they can actually hear the instruction and be obedient to it and not be held accountable for their actions, if that makes sense. And he goes on to verse 8. But if any provide not for his own, meaning those of his own house, and especially or his kin or his direct family, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. He don't give a crap. He don't have any concern. He's in a mind frame of abandonment. He doesn't want to deal with it. He has no love and care, especially for those of his own household. He might as well be considered a damn unbeliever because he's acting the same way after the manner of Gentiles. You know, it appears that Paul has to reinforce to Timothy in the midst of addressing the state of widows that the provision still ultimately falls on the men of the house, whether it be sons of the widows or husbands of families, that they still have a duty and obligation to provide and support and to not be as the unbelievers what they might do in abandoning their responsibilities. So this is still following the same understanding. I want to use the word narrative as was laid out in the beginning. I don't see any difference at all from how a widow was taken care of from back then to now. She was provided for under the command of the Most High. We're seeing the same exact thing here. Nothing new. Paul is not writing new. This is not a new fiction or an insertion. Paul knew he was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, man, tribe of Benjamin. He had a pedigree. He knew the Torah inside and out. He knew exactly what it said. He knew how it was representative to each man and group of people. So who better to be able to explain to Timothy how to deal with especially widows and their state, right? 1 Timothy chapter 5, continuing on, verse 9. Still talking about widows. Paul is really adamant about making sure that you get a perfect understanding and the widows get an understanding what the position and place is and what they should be doing with themselves because they are widows and how they should be handling, like conducting their life. He's laying it all out there for Timothy so they can all be blameless. And he goes on to instruct Timothy again, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, which of course is 60 years old, having been the wife of one man. Very interesting phrase, having been the wife of one man. So why would Paul make such a statement when he states having been the wife of one man? All right? We know under the Levirate law that a widow woman without children was to be joined to her dead husband's brother so that she might have children to carry on the name of her deceased husband. So would this then disqualify her be considered for the number? Because she has to go ahead and get married, right? Because she's going to having two husbands, not just one. But she's going to be forced by Torah to be married again, and this means two husbands. Paul, in his own words, twice made it known that a woman whose husband had passed was no longer bound to the law to her husband, that she was freed from the covenant marriage of her now dead husband, could then marry again. So I just got my notes in here, basically, and we know that Paul not only says it here in 1 Timothy, I hope I'm not losing anybody, also in Romans 7, that a woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but when he's dead, she's free to marry whoever. But again, that means it's not sinful for a widow to, you know, if a husband wants to take her. But up until that point, she remains a widow. But obviously on the Torah, she's free to actually be joined to a man that would cover her. Okay, and would this relate back to a sentiment that derived from the ancients? A widowed woman and her children would carry the name of the house of the now dead husband and father. So the seed would carry his name, even though he's dead. What was it considered an improper thing to do to raise up the children, the seed of another man, when those children and their mother bore the name and bloodline of their husband and father? See, these are things that I'm making a little more sense even to myself, that it, because the phrase is having been the wife of one man. So what is the reason for that, right? Why can she only be allowed to this, quote, this special group, this number, and the implicit instruction from Paul to Timothy is that she can't be included if she's had more than one husband, right? This is a special group of widow. I don't know of any group. You don't find it any place else, but we're going to kind of make a determination about what that was. But and I'm just speculating that maybe it had something to do with, you know, another man's taking her as a wife and her seed not being, you know, his, anyway, deceased husband. All right, glory to the King. I hope I didn't mess you up, because I got notes all over the place and typing, and sometimes I get kind of lost here a little bit. But anyway, glory to the King. I hope that made some sense. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 10. Again, we're talking about these widows that are included in this number. And Paul, again, he said they have to be 60 years of age. We're going to break this all down. And all the criteria they have to meet to be included in this special group. Okay, they have to be well reported of for good works, if she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every work. There is nowhere in the Bible where the term and meaning of number is identified, right? We can only assume that, well, you can look behind the definition, but there really isn't one. We can only assume that the term number meant a special isolated group of widows, those over age 60 and older, those who never had another husband and were the virgins to their first husbands, those who had good report of the assembly, those who had brought up children, their own and the descendants or grandchildren, if they have lodged strangers, if they had washed the feet of saints. This is all the stuff that Paul, they're servants, right? These women, these widows, they love to serve. They're all about serving God's people. If they ever relieved the afflicted, they're about doing good works. If they have diligently followed good works, and possibly if these are the same widows who trust in Yah, as we read earlier, the ones that are also widows indeed are the ones that are actually in this number, who trust in Yah and who are truly desolate, means single alone, and who continue in supplications and prayers day and night. So we have this number, we have this group of widows, and they have a special designation, and we just read what their criteria was to actually afford them the privilege of being this so-called group. Whether it was a prayer group of widows or whatever the case may be, again, I don't know, maybe somebody else knows where the definition of the number is, but those counted in this group, basically what it is. All right, 1 Timothy 5:11. Now we've talked about widows indeed. We've talked about the older widows. We've talked about how they're supposed to conduct themselves. Paul's laying it all out. Now he's going to go on. He's going to start talking about the younger widows. Again, there's a whole slew of widows that Paul is making sure that Timothy understands how to deal with these widows. Verse 11, but the younger widows refuse. Okay, that refusal hasn't to do with marriage. It has to do with being included in this number, because these younger widows in no way, shape, or form could even come close to meeting the criteria to be included in the number. Paul says, I don't want you to consider them. They're not worthy of this. Only the ones that I just told you about and the attitudes that they actually display. But the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton, that means when they start to rebel against, show insolence and neglect against Christ, they will marry. So these younger widows are starting to develop an attitude, right? And Paul's going to show more about this attitude. Again, the refusal of the younger widows is the refusal to allow them into the, quote, number, or that special group, of which is only reserved for the older widows who are over the age of 60 and exhibit a number of telling attitudes and works which allow them into this number. This was not, again, a refusal, meaning to be refused to be allowed to be married. Paul is not anti-marriage, but he understood something, especially when it comes to the widows, about how Yah dealt with them way back then. And he's dealing with them in the same direction, the same instruction, the same understanding that it was back in the Old Testament. So, again, and there also appears to be some of that same conveyance of speech, like Paul just said, that same idea, that same understanding as it comes to, the attitude for those that are married and those that are not married, right? And the same thing with, obviously falling a widow, she's not married. She had been married, but she's not married. So there also appears to be some of that same conveyance of speech in 1 Corinthians 7, when Paul is encouraging men and women to focus on serving the Messiah rather than the focus being on each other. So the focus, just like it was about the widows and their supplications, prayers, their trust in Yah, and all that other stuff, he was trying to repeat the same understanding or the same narrative for a diverse group of people, including the widows, that the focus needs to be most on the Messiah rather than on each other. And again, my notes, in the Old Testament, Yahweh was always the one who was the provider and protector of the widow and the fatherless, meaning that the widow and fatherless only had Yah to look to. Not another human being, but just Yah. And that same idea reflected in Paul's writings, which I've been saying. So we're going to jump over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 32 through 35. Paul writes to the church at Corinth, "But I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to Yahweh, how he may please Yahweh." So Paul is going to start breaking down people's states and how their focus should be. So it's his understanding and observation that they that are unmarried, obviously, they care for the things of Yahweh that belong to the Most High and pertain to His kingdom, how He may please the Most High. But he that is married care for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. Obviously, your focus changed because you've got flesh and flesh, one flesh. Again, Paul is not anti-marriage, never has been, but he's just kind of reiterating to us that he doesn't want us to lose our focus. What's the most pertinent, important thing that could ever be is that's their servitude to the Most High. Just, by simple observation and being a part of this and all the travels, Paul obviously had the authority to write this because he witnessed this stuff, right? There is difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman, so you can apply the same unmarried state to a widow. She's not married. She's unmarried. She has a dead husband. She's not joined to anybody. So you can apply the same understanding or the same mindset of Paul also to the widow as well as the unmarried woman. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of Yah, that she may be holy, set apart both in body and in spirit. But she that is married care for the things of the world, how she may please her. This is just common sense understanding, right? It truly is. It really is, because obviously, when you have a husband or wife, the time that you may spend in conversation with them or engage in activity, if you were unmarried, that same amount of time may be going directly to the Most High in prayer and in fasting or in reading or in study, or in witnessing, or whatever the case may be. So Paul is not wrong at all about how he's explaining this or how he's representing the different aspects of being married or unmarried. And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you. Paul was not trying to discourage anybody from marriage. That's not what he was saying. He was simply pointing out the fact that when you become married, your cares may change. And so he's trying to get people to refocus and relook at what is more important in this life. Not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and you, that you may attend unto Yahweh without distraction. Because Paul, you know, we know that he was a single man, right? Now, Paul sums up his words in this very verse when he makes it plain about his intentions towards the saints when it comes to marriage and the distractions it will bring in regards to a complete commitment to the Master Jesus Christ. His intent is not to talk anyone out of marriage. As Paul states, he doesn't desire to cast a snare upon any, but rather place emphasis on what marriage can do in regards to one's focus and concern as it has to do with serving Yahweh. Paul is simply giving some what he believes good advice. I kind of talked about that already. All right. I personally believe Paul was in no way, shape, or form against marriage, but he carried an emphasis on serving the Creator, on serving the Messiah over serving each other as husband and wife. I believe wholeheartedly that Paul's words, Paul's attention, his ideology, and his counsel line up perfectly and reflect the admonishment of Yahshua when he instructed us to first seek the kingdom of Yah, not a mate, not a husband looking for a wife, not a wife looking for a husband. So Paul is just capitalizing and implying again the same thing that Jesus said. Seek ye first the kingdom of Yah and all his righteousness, and then all these things will be added unto you if it's necessary for you to get to the kingdom, to enhance you, to perfect you. If a man's ways please Yah, Yah will give him the desires of his house. But the precedent is you have to have ways that please the Most High. Yah will give him the desires of his heart. But there is precedent in both examples to focus on the Father and the Son and concentrate your devotion towards him. I can easily see this in Paul's direction to the widow and to those who seek marriage. I also believe some may get too caught up in the idea of marriage because it's spoken about in the ministry here all the time, and their focus is more on marriage. How is it spoken of quite frequently over a single desire to serve Christ and be content as we are? Again, if you're seeking first the kingdom of Yah, how can you be seeking anything else? However, much of the purpose of speaking so much on marriage, and the reason that especially Pastor Dowell talks about it so much, is to help prepare those who will be entering into the covenant to understand what they're entering into and ensure that they will be successful. But this in no way should be construed as marriage remaining the only course. I also wonder if Paul had thoughts of what the focus was of the created man and woman prior to the fall. And if you look at it, it lines up, there's a real definite thought here. If they looked to their Elohim more than each other, this was before the fall, when Adam was created and then Eve, right? Remember how Yahweh sentenced Eve and all women afterward, how that the woman's desire was now going to be to her husband and that the husband would now rule over her. So what was the order before Yah passed this judgment upon all women? Was the original state of the created man and woman more so towards Yah and not so much towards each other? Could it have been? This is just something to consider. And it might be considered taking things out of context to believe that Paul understood that natural Israel as such no longer needed to sustain themselves as a nation through propagation, meaning having children, but that rather Paul understood that Israel now consisted of whoever the Most High chose to place his spirit in, people of all tongues, men out of all nations, as we read in Acts chapter 2, thereby sustaining Israel as a nation and people of the Most High. So he already knew that Yah could build a nation just by putting his spirit in all kinds of different people, not so much having so many children to sustain the nation, if you understand what I'm saying. Armed with that knowledge, brothers and sisters could then serve the Most High at a deeper level without the consideration of marriage in order to raise sons and daughters to keep Israel intact as a nation of believers. Ultimately, though, we have to decide if these words of Paul were fiction written by the hand of someone promoting other agendas, and what was that agenda, or were these sincerely the words of Paul, and did they reflect another aspect of serving Yah but never going against Torah or the inherent right of men and women to marry and raise a family? And quickly, I'm going to touch here on something about inheritance, all right, because it plays a crucial part when a man and woman come together in Israel. We just read it in Numbers that, you know, they have a seed. The man's seed is the one that's going to inherit what the man's possession, their father's possession, right? So when we come to the dispensation of the assembly now after the death, burial, and resurrection of Yahshua, there's a change, a difference in looking or understanding what the inheritance part meant. So how do the laws governing person and family Torah inheritance now stand in this dispensation? Where are we striving toward living? Where we are striving toward living together in common unity, where we have sold homes, lands, and possessions, as it says in Acts chapter 4, and give them wholly over for the use of saints, because by doing such, as is the command, there would be no inheritance to pass down to the seed, to pass down to the children, if you understand what I'm saying. Where now is the person? Where now is the personal family inheritance that was commanded in the Torah? Would it stand to reason that those of the early assembly who laid their possessions at the apostle's feet parted with the inheritance meant to go to their seed? Did they understand that? Did they know that? But what did they know that was different? The inheritance is still there. It still is there for the children. But it is the inheritance in the whole and the communities. What are the children that have left, like in this community here, what are these children that have left this community? Are they afforded the inheritance of that which is meant to remain for those who stayed the course? No, they're not. They've actually forsook their inheritance because the inheritance stays within the faithful. Not so much the family structure anymore. It stays amongst the faithful, and the community reflects that perfectly. If I had children living on this community and they were faithful, they would receive of my inheritance through the community, that which I invested all at the beginning. They would actually be partakers, and they would get to inherit, still going in line with Torah, the possessions that I had, but it become common use. Paul said that the parents were to lay up for their children, and this is now accomplished by the parents giving all into living in common unity, which if their children remain faithful, they will still be afforded the inheritance, so the seed will still get the inheritance. It's just not personal anymore. It's as a whole. This then is not contrary to the Old Testament Torah, the Old Testament laws, to the seemingly new framework of the New Testament, but rather it promotes greater focus towards the Messiah and his kingdom. Both is the idea of marriage and inheritance. And the reason I went through all that and made all that a point is because Paul talking about marriage, and more so the attitude of he was placing on the widows, to your focus should be on serving Christ. On the unmarried, they're going to have less distractions. They can have more intimate time with the Most High. So it's not so much about the emphasis is about finding somebody to marry, have a seed, so you can pass your possessions down to them. The possession now in this dispensation comes through the way of the whole, if that made sense. Hallelujah. All right, back to 1 Timothy. We're jumping back in there. And again, we left off talking about the younger widows refuse because when they have begun waxing wanton against Christ, they will marry. So now we're going into verse 12. And Paul is saying they're going to have damnation, meaning they're going to be standing in judgment because they have cast off their first faith. And how did they do that? Because they waxed wanton, because they reviled against, they showed insolence towards and neglect against Christ. This is where the judgment, the standing in judgment, is going to come off because they have removed their focus and their thoughts and their mindset away from Christ, and they have put him something else in his place that they believe is more important. The word cast off means to do away with, to set aside, to disregard, to thwart the efficacy of anything, to nullify, make void, frustrate, to reject, to refuse, to slight. So these young widows have effectively, they've set aside, they disregarded, they've done away with, they've refused, they've rejected, they made void their first faith because their mind is centered on other things, and that is to find another husband. Not wait for one maybe to take them, but to actively pursue, and because there's something more engaged in pleasure through having a husband, right? I believe Paul, again, is reflecting on Torah. All right, 1 Timothy 5:13. And withal, at the same time, again, still talking about these younger widows. At the same, and withal, meaning at the same time, at the same time that they're portraying these other, they're actually walking this other behavior, they're actually having this, their mind is starting to go this way, to cast off their first faith, to go against Christ, to neglect Christ, to neglect their time with him, their personal time. They learn to be idle, which is lazy and useless, and when they're learning, they're actually learning, they're practicing to be idle, which is lazy and useless, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle or lazy or useless, but tattlers also in busybodies, speaking things which they ought not, because their focus has totally gotten away from the Most High. They're still young, they're still impressionable, they got a different attitude, they got a different scope in life, they have the hormones working for them and everything else, so their mind really isn't on the one that saved them, but more so for them to procure a husband, right? And this Paul is saying by his experience and observation, how else could he write this knowing other than actually seeing this himself and warning Timothy what is these younger women, or younger widows, excuse me, are going to begin to do. How could Paul write of such behavior unless he had firsthand observation and knowledge of the shame of the young widows to walk after the flesh? It is quite obvious that such manifestation of wickedness would not be accepted into, remember we talked about the number that was reserved for the sober-minded, serious age widows. How could you? With that kind of behavior, they were already disqualified because of age, the younger widows, but all this behavior, that's why Paul said, ain't no may, you refuse them, even if they look like they had the same attributes as an older widow, you forget that because their mind is still vulnerable to actually walk after what he just got done talking about. But you may ask why didn't Paul simply advocate or support for a husband to be placed over these rebellious younger widows to bring them in line? I mean, wouldn't that have been the obvious question? Just give marry him off to a husband. Wouldn't that make the most sense, be the logical, rational choice? Should that then have been the same mindset for the widows of Israel of old? You have to just look at the parallel. Again, Paul understood perfectly the reasoning behind the commandments established by Yahweh himself for the care and support of a widow with her children, that it wasn't an issue of not having a husband, but more so having a heart towards Yahweh and trusting in him. And then, okay, so then Paul goes on to talk about, now he's left off the younger widows, now he's going to talk about the younger women. We're almost done. I intend then, that the younger women marry. So Paul's intention is that the younger women marry. Bear children, younger women obviously going to be those of a virgin nature. Bear children, guide the house, give none occasion or no opportunity to the adversary or those who are against and opposed to living holy to speak reproachfully or slanderously. So Paul is saying that he would rather the younger women marry as opposed to the younger widows. Younger women meaning the virgin daughters, the ones that haven't had children, the ones that haven't guided the house. Okay? So that's his intention here. Paul makes it plain to Timothy why he would have it this way, as to prevent the adversaries to speak in slander of the assembly, which reflect on Elohim, the Elohim they serve, the word of Yah, be not blasphemed. So, again, his focus was let the younger women, the older, the other widows and the younger widows, the old, they've all had husbands before, and let them not so much concentrate on being covered again, but more so with just serving Christ, serving the Most High. They'll be taken care of. They've all their excuses have been taken away because the assembly was charged either directly by a male figure in the house, by a son or a daughter, but they were taken care of, so there was no need for them to actually pursue a husband to provide for them, because that was all taken care of. You know, the stuff was laid at the apostle feet, distribution was made to every man as he had need. So again, the emphasis was on serving Christ. And 5:15, for some are already turned aside after Satan, meaning the adversaries, those that were part of the faith, they've left, and they're out there, they've left the faith, they're slandering and trying to find fault and failure with everything that is going on in the assembly. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, so again, Paul is going to reiterating how these widows are to be taken care of, let them relieve them, which simply means to aid, to defend, to give assistance to them, and let not the assembly be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. Okay, them that are worthy of the title and honor of the widows indeed. So, anyway, that concludes the study. I know it was rather long. I figured it might be. I just pray that there was some understanding that was able to come out of this. And then the most important thing is that Paul wasn't trying to change anything. Paul wasn't trying to institute new customer laws or new direction when he wrote to Timothy. Simply, he was just reiterating the understanding that was already there in the ancient times concerning the widows with children and the fatherless, right? And how that they were never covered, and they went through their lives knowing that they may never be covered, right? And that Yah was the defender of them, the provider for them, the protection, all the things that a husband would do with a wife and a father would do with their children in the house, if that makes sense. And so I don't think Paul in no way, shape, or form was in changing anything or adding anything new or inventing anything. He was simply following what was already in place. So anyway, again, I hope that this was understandable, and glory to the King. But I pray you all have a good week. Remember to continue to pray for Pastor Dowell and for Pastor Corey, those in leadership, the elders, the deacons, the heads of assembly, the leadership, and for each other, that we can all get to the King together. So I pray you all have a blessed week, and you know, you're profitable to the kingdom. All right. Much shalom, blessings, Israel.